I knew that that was the end of the road when I saw lots of green and red lasers on my chest of snipers pointing at us. And I was like, okay, I think that the game, the jig might be up. Beating, abusing, torturing people immediately, throwing a grandma to the floor and breaking her leg, threw me like Greta in front of the flag of the State of Israel to sort of show this is what we do to disloyal Jews. You know, a treatment that we can only imagine is a fraction of what Palestinian political prisoners are suffering.
Welcome to Doomscroll. I'm your host, Joshua Citarella. My guest is David Adler of the Progressive International.
The day before I was set to get on the boat, the family boat, which was the principal vessel of the Global Sumud Flotilla, our boat suffered the first of several drone attacks in the middle of the night. I was having dinner with Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur for the Occupied Palestinian Territories, and Ada Colau, a friend of mine, the former mayor of Barcelona, who was on the boat and had kind of encouraged me to come. And Francesca got a call from one of the members of the steering committee, from Thiago Avila, who was like, get down to the port now. And so we sped down to the port in the car and saw the boat 100 meters off the Tunisian coast where it had been parked, just in flames.
It's not even set sail. It's just like parked outside the port.
Yeah. So as we later learned, Benjamin Netanyahu had personally approved the deployment of a submarine that would send this quadricopter to deploy an incendiary device onto the boat to try to blow it up.
How, if one country sends a bomb into the territory of another country, how is that not breaking like a dozen different international laws right now?
So this was the initial scandal in the port of Sidi Bou Said, where we were based at the time, was the boat was not just in the port of Tunis. It was approximately 1 kilometer away from the presidential palace of Tunisia.
Oh boy, okay.
Now, mind you, on the same day, exact same day, the State of Israel had bombed Syria and Lebanon.
Right. Right.
You know, these guys have gone so rogue. But without digressing, you know, it was for that reason, Josh, that 20 minutes after we had come to the port, the Tunisian authorities had already blamed us, blamed the boats themselves, said this must have been a cigarette or a technical failure, because it's a humiliating thing to admit.
Now, okay.
This leaves us in a very complicated position.
Yeah.
Unfortunately for them, there was very good CCTV footage of the bomb exploding on the boat. And even worse for them was that precisely 24 hours later, there was a second drone attack on the second largest vessel of the fleet, which had even more scandalous CCTV footage, at which point the Tunisian authorities changed their story and called this a premeditated aggression
by
someone.
Yeah.
So this was kind of my welcome to the party was,
yeah,
you know,
welcome indeed.
This, on the one side, the real sense of solidarity and support to be surrounded by so many different walks of people and so many different ages and social strata, as well as all these Tunisians who were throwing open the doors of hospitality to us, you know, people who have been similarly watching this genocide unfold on their TV screens and on their cell phones and feeling totally powerless in their efforts to stop it. On the one hand, feeling that sense of support and solidarity that's so motivating. On the other hand, really recognizing that we were putting our lives at risk and that at that time, especially, kind of no one cared.
You're getting bombed before you even depart.
Right. Yeah. It was very hard. I mean, we're ringing the alarm. You know, Greta's doing an Instagram live. I'm calling representatives in Washington.
That part is calling, so surreal to me.
Calling the president of Colombia saying, can you tweet about this thing? We're doing our best to alert the international community to the active threats against our lives and against the mission. A protected mission of humanitarian law. But at that point in time, it's not really working. And I think it's important to sort of start the story there, Josh, because I think it's easy to tell the story of the flotilla backwards from, oh, you know, these were just a bunch of activists. We're always going to be okay. They're always protected. You know, it's just about, it's a selfie boat or whatever. Hmm. But as I think, you know, you'll discover as we read the story forwards, it was a kind of case of pure politics, of how we could really build global solidarity, visibility, support, and mobilization around this mission that could represent hope to so many people and ultimately beat back a lot of these kind of lethal attacks on our lives. From Tunisia, board the boats, and off we sail into the Mediterranean Sea. Now we've got the Barcelona fleet and the Maghreb fleet, and I'm introduced to nautical life. 30 people packed into like a 12-person boat.
Tight quarters,
smells like shit. Lots of exciting chores. And then the rest of the kind of diplomatic and political coordination that we were trying to do from the boat. How do we get governments to care? How do we get diplomats to respond? How do we get representatives to speak out? How do we coordinate with trade unions, as we saw in Italy, to say, you know, we're going to go on a general strike if things happen to the fleet. So a lot of the political work that needed to be done to make this mission more than the sum of its individual fishing boats, you know, swimming across the Mediterranean Sea. One of the things that was happening at the time is that we were sailing at the same moment that the United Nations was meeting. And so we tried to create a kind of these two images. You had the formal diplomats sitting at the UN and doing fuck all to help with the genocide in Gaza. And then you had people, ordinary people who were taking, they're putting their lives at risk to address the humanitarian crisis in Gaza and boarding these boats and sailing, you know, eating chickpeas and rice every day to try to deliver this humanitarian aid. And I think that that was really inspiring for a lot of people. But the real kind of critical juncture, I think, in the story of the Global Summit Flotilla happened when we were off the coast of Crete. At that time, in a remarkable turn of events, somehow we'd managed to put together the Spanish fleet and the Maghreb fleet, the Italian fleet, and we're putting together the Greek fleet. So this is a moment at which all of the boats are finally coming together for the first time before the final leg we come to Gaza. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm asleep before my drone shift because every night for 3 hours at a time, we would take shifts monitoring the night skies for drones to alert the crew of any kind of imminent attack on the boats, which no longer seemed like such an exaggeration based on what we'd suffered in Tunisia. So I was sleeping ahead of my shift that was set to start at 3 a.m. when I heard the alarm go off on the boat, which is like a signal to like, go get up. You know, we had been running drills every single day. Get your life vests, get ready to jump into a boat like we're abandoning ship. So I come up from the bottom of the deck and I am just hearing these loud explosions, one after the other, just and meanwhile, the captain is telling us that over the radio, they're just hearing, lay all your love on. They're blasting ABBA as a kind of.
Wow.
So they'd sent a swarm of drones to drop like C-40 charges to try to blow up the bows of these sailing boats and are trolling Greta in particular by blasting ABBA on the radio.
Okay.
And it's this heady mix of like, this is a terror attack, but it's also, is it funny? Is it terrible?
And it goes on while bombing people. Yeah.
And it goes on for hours. I mean, 3 hours just in the dead of night, like explosion after explosion after explosion.
Are they successful at disabling some of these boats?
Yeah, so a bunch of boats are really badly damaged come morning, and there has to be a whole kind of regrouping strategy.
Yeah.
And at that point, we were trying to avoid Greek territorial waters because Greece, very close ally of the state of Israel, so much so that when the Israelis were raining bombs on Iran, the presidential prime ministerial plan Netanyahu just kind of parked itself in or over Athens as a kind of protected space for the Israelis.
Wow.
So we were trying to avoid going to Greek territorial waters. But after this extremely scary drone swarm, it was so scary. I mean, I couldn't believe my eyes. The piracy of it, the illegality of it, the brazenness of it, the rogue aspect of this drone strike. It was impossible to imagine another country, maybe other than the United States, who would have be so brazen as to like drone strike at sea, totally helpless and vulnerable, a group of just humanitarian workers and ordinary citizens.
This kind of goes to the point of what you were saying before, is that Israel's actions just seem unconstrained by any international law. There's not even the pretense of them abiding by it.
it is clear that over the course of this genocide, Israel has gotten wildly high on its own supply. Mm-hmm. And that has manifested not just in, you know, videos that the soldiers themselves are recording of war crimes that they're committing and celebrating and uploading them to Instagram.
Posting it to TikTok, yeah.
But it also goes to the kind of ludicrous, absurd, cheap propaganda that they mounted against us.
Yeah.
So part of the drone strikes we were suffering, the reason why they were scary was because, you know, Israelis had to make a very difficult decision in the way that they depicted the Global Sumud Flotilla. Either we were going to be the selfie yacht, the celebrity pleasure cruise that they'd painted the Andala and the boat before it as, you know, just sort of like little mosquitoes that they were trying to swat away.
You're also the Hamas flotilla.
Or do they go the 2010 route and say, these are terrorists.
Right.
And set the stage for a more violent interception.
Right.
Abduction. Right. And so it became clear to us, especially after Tunisia, when Israel was kind of on the back foot to explain why they'd done this, that they were going to lean hard into the second paradigm. We were the Hamas flotilla, and every day there was new formal communication coming out from the foreign ministry about why people on the boats were, you know, a menace to national security, were connected to international criminal terrorist networks. And so very fucking scary stuff. In the case of the drone strikes off the coast of Crete, we were able to work with that. You know, this was when we really pushed the red button and were like, they are going to kill us.
Right.
And it was at that point that I think we got a lot more people to pay attention in the high halls of governments, as well as at level of sort of social mobilizations. And that was when, for example, at the threat of a general strike, even the government of Giorgia Meloni promised to send a frigate to just protect our safety, never mentioning Israel.
Wow.
But they were going to send a naval ship just to be kind of a kilometer away as we sailed across the Mediterranean, making sure that we're safe.
Yeah.
And that's when Spain as well agreed to send from Cartagena their own naval frigate as well. So this is when things really escalate from being a scrappy group of activists and crazy people from around the world who've come together based on that moral conviction to being a true geopolitical confrontation. Countries like Italy, countries like Spain, less so, had been avoiding such direct confrontation with the state of Israel. Mm-hmm. And here we were successfully drawing them on the high seas into this kind of confrontation. And that made for the most spectacular moments of my life. Like gazing across the sea and seeing all of these small boats come together in this beautiful collective display of solidarity, seeing these huge naval frigates who were supposedly defending our safety, and seeing these giant Turkish drones every night that were just monitoring the airspace, trying to make sure that we weren't attacked. And this, I think, is the power of the flotilla, even before I get to what we endured on the other side of the journey. Ultimately, it's just a bunch of boats with a very humble amount of humanitarian aid. But, you know, in a world where billions of people were outraged by this genocide and billions of people were seeing it live streamed hour by hour and day by day, this kind of direct action, I think, is so powerful to people who want so badly for their governments to represent them. You know, the crisis of the genocide is not just a crisis of Israel-Palestine. It's a reflection of a global democratic crisis in which these governments on sensitive geopolitical issues have ceased to represent their citizens. This is a well-established fact in the political science literature that however representative your system of domestic policymaking may be, it's foreign policy that's always the least representative, the most out of step with people's issues. If you were to ask me why Jeremy Corbyn was so badly slandered and ultimately deposed from the leadership of the Labour Party, it's not because of what he said on healthcare and housing. It's because of what he said on nuclear deterrence. It's because of what he said on NATO. It's because of what he said on Palestine. Right. Those are the things that scare the real kind of political establishment the most. And that's where that establishment is most out of step with the peoples of the world. So I think that's when the flotilla, the global Samud flotilla, became so much greater than some of its individual parts. And there were so many eyes on the operation as we entered the kind of last leg in the so-called red zone, a fictional part of international waters that Israel has simply said, we have jurisdiction here. They don't. But they patrol and say, if you cross this, you know, like pirates, we can't protect you from ourselves. I mean, a ludicrous kind of blackmail.
Okay. I mean, they're just making it up as they go along. So why not?
Yeah, they're just making up new rules of engagement. And you know, they had a tough kind of decision to make about how they wanted to deal with us. I have no doubt that they wanted to kill us at the beginning of the mission. Not just because the drone attacks, not just because of the propaganda, but because this was such a globally Southern representative mission. It was had so much Arab representation. This was going to represent the largest, you know, Israel has done such an effective job between, you know, blowing up the Gaza airport, destroying its ports, between controlling checkpoints that choke off entry to the West Bank, at isolating the occupied territories. As a means of starving out kind of pan-Arab solidarities, it's really hard for Arabs to go to Palestine, whereas it's very easy for a Canadian or an Australian to go to Israel.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
So it's not just about Palestine. It's also about Palestine's position in a broader international solidarity movement. And, you know, Israel's terrified of a Palestinian state, but they're even more terrified about a global solidarity movement to stand with that Palestinian state. And the flotilla came to represent that threat to them. And so we were sure that, you know, even if some wider global northern people were protected, some of the poor global southern people were not just likely, but very well were set to endure, suffer, or even, you know, die at the hands of a lethal intervention by Israeli forces.
Yeah.
But that mobilization was really successful. We had the frigates, we had drones, and we had millions of people watching from all around the world. And so by the time we got into the red zone, I think I was feeling a bit more confident. Okay, maybe we'll reach the shores of Gaza. Maybe we'll be able to provide. Maybe we'll do what the flotillas have not been able to do in so long, which is actually reach the people of Gaza, you know, break this illegal siege. And in doing so, not just push back against this rogue actor, but as you say, Josh, reveal the Wizard of Oz aspect of the State of Israel. You know, one problem that we have is that we imagine them to be invincible and, you know, omnipotent through technologies like Pegasus, right? Like they're everywhere and they're so powerful and they have all this air force and they have these toys that are given to them by the United States. And so we let them set the rules of engagement. And so one of the things I was really excited about in helping to coordinate this mission and being one of its participants was, if we can break the siege, then one of the major fictions, that's just imposed out of thin air by the State of Israel, that we control the shores of Gaza, that this blockade is legitimate, that Gazans shouldn't have the right to control their shores, something that would be unthinkable to other people in the world. If a Californian, you know, if a child in California were at risk of being shot to death for swimming in the Pacific Ocean, or the ability to fish in Northern California was determined by China, I mean, we would never stand for this kind of thing. But all of a sudden in Gaza, it's acceptable. So I was feeling kind of ready and eager for this kind of confrontation because I didn't know how far we'd be able to take it. Little did we know that there had been a kind of secret agreement that was signed between the Italians, Spaniards less so, and the State of Israel regarding our interception. So in the last leg of the journey, the Italian government really did not want these boats to reach the red zone. Okay. And so they made a concerted push to get the boats to stop and us to hand over all of our aid to the Cypriot government, who would then give it to the Vatican in Jerusalem, who would then distribute it in Gaza. The most like Rube Goldberg ridiculous idea.
Okay.
And also like what we're going to trust is like you who are blocking all the trucks from getting in from Rafah and elsewhere. Yeah. Like we're not going to trust you to take our aid off of our boats. So we turned down that offer and we kept sailing. And the Italians were very worried about what might happen, about the social upheaval that might happen if something really lethal, a lethal kinetic intervention were to take place. So a secret agreement was kind of made that the Italian frigate and the Spanish frigate as well, would turn around before they reached the red zone to preserve the integrity of the Israeli blockade of Gaza if the Israelis promised not to kill us that night. And so the Israelis have a problem, which is they don't really have a navy. It's kind of just a bunch of kids on meth hanging out on boats, you know? I mean, most Israeli armies like that. And so we're sailing like into the darkness. It's like a half moon overhead. And we're just seeing these naval forces with giant lights kind of swarm towards the different boats. It's very confusing what's going on. And it's made more confusing by the fact that every time one of those naval boats from the Israelis gets closer to one of our boats, all of our signals get jammed. We can't communicate. Right, we can't access the Wi-Fi and stuff like that. It's very tough to know what's going on. Now, you may ask, why were the Israelis so keen to cut communications and jam our signals?
Why were they?
Well, I think to understand that, we have to make a brief pause about how the state of Israel is covered in our prestige press, which is that our pundits are very easily duped by the state of Israel. And the state of Israel is very creative about how they play them like a fiddle, which is to say they take advantage of a time inconsistency in Israelis' kinetic actions, where, you know, the headline, I believe the New York Times ran when we were bombed, said, boats struck by drone, activists say. You know, so when something happens on the activist side, it's always, you know, measured. But when Israel says something.
Yeah.
And so what they wanted to do, as they did in 2010 very effectively when they murdered all those humanitarian activists on the flotilla, was do whatever they wanted to do, whatever they felt like they had to do, kill us, maim us, drown us, and then put out a communique saying, oh, we provoked it, and there would be no footage
to prove it. So they're blocking your communications so that you can't get a signal out.
That's right.
To tell an alternate story.
And we're doing the best that we can. Every boat has CCTV. The steering committee did a brilliant job in arming all these boats for security purposes with as good technology as they could have to make sure that we're broadcasting to the world, which I think speaks, Josh, you know, to your area of particular interest about the ways in which technology is actually critical to, let's say, progressive or humanitarian causes as much as it is an infrastructure that is used or weaponized by the right. But here we are, dead of night, eve of Yom Kippur, very symbolic moment as a Jew that on the basis of my own feelings of atonement for the sins committed by my people in the occupied territories, I'm sailing to Gaza and the Israeli Navy on the day of the holiest day of the year is preparing to, you know, abduct, kidnap, if not outright kill us at sea. And so we're sailing through the middle of the night. Every once in a while we'll turn, we'll see a boat, and they're firing like skunk water cannons onto these small fishing boats, which I think had the principal aim of disabling all the tech on the boats so no one had cell phones or the cameras wouldn't work, but had the secondary benefit of damaging the boats and drowning the people on them. So we're like, okay, we need to get not water cannoned if we can. We're going to try to sail our way through this night sky. And so the Israelis had set like a kind of what they perceived to be a blockade in the middle of the sea. And we're like, everyone stop, turn off your engines. And we were just like, fuck you, you have no jurisdiction here. We're going to keep sailing. So we kept on sailing right through the blockade. And they did not like that. So there was a huge naval frigate, maybe 500 times the size of our boat. Huge. Mm-hmm. And I think that they'd been hoping to use it as a prison at sea to bring all the boats there, load everyone onto a prison, and then take them to shore. But it really liked us for some reason. So we end up in this kind of lethal game of cat and mouse with this giant frigate, giant naval boat, that they would try to chase us down and try to ram our little fishing boat, little sailing boat in half. Mm-hmm. And we would try to outsail them. And when we would try to sail away, they had these huge water cannons that they were shooting at our boat. So I was like, well, this could go any number of ways. They're definitely not holding back from trying to harm us. But we have no idea what's happening to the other boats, how far along they are. Maybe some of them will get through. We didn't really know what was going to happen. And if I'm being completely honest, maybe I was a little too confident. I thought, well, look at how much support we built up. We had these naval boats, we had the Turkish drones. You know, maybe we'll get through. I was wrong. We sailed and sailed, but around 4:30 in the morning, just before sunrise, they came for us. I knew that was the end of the road when I saw lots of green and red lasers on my chest of snipers pointing at us. And I was like, okay, I think that the jig might be up. And so they, you know, approached the boats, two giant kind of rafts full of, army men, naval men, approached the boats and boarded the boats. And the first thing they did was took bats and they broke every camera. They caught every cable. They smashed every piece of technology they could find. At that point, of course, we'd thrown our phones into the sea so they couldn't see anything on them. But they destroyed everything. Terrifying, of course. Don't want to understate how criminal this was. But also, I think it would be accurate to describe it as just a simple act of piracy. Here we were in international waters. A hostile rogue army was boarding civilian boats, throwing us into the cabin and just taking the boat. So we were just like prisoners on our boat that they didn't own, that they were just taking with us as captives.
Yeah.
And so that's when they took us, one by one, ship by ship, that they boarded and commandeered, I guess would be the relevant naval phrase. And they took us to the port of Ashdod, the large port, which was a very long journey. We were close enough to Gaza. We'd gotten 42 nautical miles away, but we hadn't got there all the way. Now, I was told later when I got out of the internment camp that even though we didn't succeed in our narrow mission, we did succeed in some part of it, which was that for 2 days, we were told, fishermen in Gaza were finally able to go out and unleash their nets and fish because the Navy was so preoccupied with managing the global Sumud flotilla. So that was very heartening. At the time, we didn't know anything about where anyone was, if everyone survived, if anyone gotten through. We were just being taken to the port. And that, Josh, is really where the nightmare began. Because if we had been protected at sea, now we were really in the Israelis' hands. And we were specifically in Minister Ben-Gvir's hands, who was going to do exactly what he'd always wanted to do with solidarity activists, which is to treat us like terrorists and give us the kind of terror protocol that usually is reserved for, you know, enemies of the state. And that is, I think, what they executed once we got to the port of Ashdod, where it became abundantly clear that we were not going to be normal prisoners. That, once I saw them beating, abusing, torturing people immediately, throwing a grandma to the floor and breaking her leg, forcing, Greta to kneel in front of the Israeli flag in the corner of the tarmac and kind of punch her around, everyone's sitting in the kind of terror pose. That's, of course, when they approached me. We're all lined up on the tarmac for this great photo opportunity for Ben-Gvir. And that's when they approached me and said, are you Jewish? Which I think that they maybe had seen from posts or something monitoring the situation. And I said, yes, I am. And that's when they sort of pulled me up by the ear and threw me, like Greta, in front of the flag of the State of Israel to sort of show, this is what we do to disloyal Jews. You're not part of this project. This is not your homeland. We're going to treat you like a terrorist. All for Ben-Gvir's kind of photo opportunistic benefit as he marched down to the port of Ashdod with his little team of photographers and videographers and social media masters to come and present the prisoners and say, look, we've captured them, as if we were anything other than just ordinary people conducting legally protected humanitarian work. So one thing that was really striking about our arrival to Ashdod was in a harrowing recollection of previous 20th century armies who'd done the same, they immediately started stripping people of their jewelry. They started confiscating people's valuables, going through their bags, throwing out their medicine, critical life-saving medicine. In the case of some of the veterans of Conscience who are on our boats, it was remarkable because they were throwing away medicine from the VA. Now, if your viewers aren't familiar, right now there's like a proposal to have Israeli soldiers be beneficiaries of the US-American VA. And here was the Israeli army throwing out medicine from the VA. I mean, the whole thing was so psychedelic. I really couldn't believe my eyes. You know, we were processed without lawyers. And then, you know, of course, strip searched naked and zip tied, blindfolded, thrown onto these buses, kind of 40 of us packed into this very hot bus, and just shipped into the middle of the desert.
Right.
I mean, effectively disappeared.
You were brought significantly deep into the desert. Do you have any sense of how long that journey was?
Yeah, multiple hours, I would say. 2.5, 3 hours. Some people got driven around for 5 hours just for fun. But we were brought deep into the Negev deserts, very close, on the border
of
Egypt.
They're just letting you overheat in the bus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we were closer to Gaza than we were even on the boats, which was a very sad spiritual thing. But one of the refrains we kept on hearing when we were in the course of the detention process was, you know, they would take away a wallet or a phone or something, and they would, and people would protest, and they would say, "You should have thought of that before you came to Israel." And we would say, "We didn't come to Israel. You abducted us in international waters and you brought us to Israel." And again, they would beat us, you know, punch us, throw us on the ground. People would say, "Don't do that, please," or whatever. They would protest and say, "You should have thought of that before you came to Israel." And so we didn't come to Israel. You abducted us. You brought us here. We're here against our will. It's so easy to normalize Zionist violence because there's so much of it. We talked about the normalization of this rogue behavior in sending out drones in the Mediterranean, but it's equally normalized how they behave to kind of prisoners or perceived enemies of the state. This was the largest abduction of U.S. citizens by adversary or ally in the 21st century.
Wow.
And instead of helping, I had Ambassador Mike Huckabee in Tel Aviv tweeting, quote tweeting me, saying this Hamas lover deserves everything that he gets, effectively putting a target on our backs and an invitation for the Israelis to treat us like terrorists. And so for 3 days, we were just disappeared from the time of abduction all into the time of our internment in this infamous kind of Guantanamo Bay of Israel called Ketziot, deep in the desert. And people were subject to such horrific treatment. You know, a treatment that we can only imagine is a fraction of what Palestinian political prisoners are suffering. In their thousands, 11,000 just since October 7th, in Gaza alone were abducted and detained and imprisoned and incarcerated to this day. And here we were, just a bunch of, like, you'd think very passport-protected, privileged humanitarian actors who were being cuffed at hands and ankles and thrown into bird cages, who were being stuffed into cells without food or water, who were being denied access to the most basic legal services. Effectively, as I came to understand later, we were being treated as prisoners of war. Very rogue behavior, very aligned with the U.S. approach, the Pete Hegseth School of International Law, we might say, where, you know, if we call you a terrorist, we can do whatever we want. And so that was kind of the, you know, the story that of our detainment. I don't want to say in a prison because it wasn't a prison. It was in a concentration camp or internment camp. That's why they built this camp. It's such an infamous camp that they had to shut it down in the early 2000s because of such sort of vivid reports of violent treatment of political prisoners after the first intifada and the second intifada, that they had to shut it down and they reopened it again. This is a 600,000 square meter facility, like a small city in the middle of nowhere. And yeah, over the course of just several days, people were treated and subject to just such horrific conditions that, you know, just as with the case of ABBA and the drone strikes, vibrated between the psychologically torturous and absurd to the very scary and physically violent. On the second day, they set up two giant screens at the front of the cell block where they just played a montage with a soundtrack and a score of footage from October 7th for 2, 3, 5, 7, 9 hours a day on maximum volume. And again, we'd say, can you please turn off this? These are horrible images. They would say, well, you should have thought of that before you came to Israel. They say, we didn't fucking come to Israel. Like, we don't want to be here. We're here against our will. And they loved me. I mean, they were fascinated by this idea of, you know, a Jewish kid from California who'd joined this flotilla. So once, twice, three times I was brought in for kind of special interrogation with these.
What do they want to know?
Cretinous Mossad things. And they all had kind of one question. Who brought you here? Who paid for you to be here?
Really?
Because the Israeli mind cannot make sense of the international solidarity movement with Palestine. To them, it is just Jew hatred and cannot be anything else. So for them to see that there is not just one, but a growing constituency of Jews in the diaspora who are standing up against this genocide, who are standing up for a different Jewish tradition, a non-Zionist, or in my case, an anti-Zionist tradition, they can't compute this idea. So to them, it must have been that, you know, Hamas sent $2,000 to my Bank of America savings account, and then I flew over to Barcelona and got a bus.
God forbid.
So I'd get paraded
You're doing
in,
it for free.
In shackles, you know, paraded out.
Yeah.
But the treatment of the prisoners was horrible. I mean, you had, you know, Paddy, 70-something Irishman who needed insulin because he's a diabetic. And we're begging insulin for cell 16, insulin, nothing, no medical attention. You've got people who are undergoing such severe withdrawals from long-term medication because they were thrown out by Israeli authorities.
Yeah.
Losing their minds, begging for support, begging, at all hours of the day, crying out, I need a doctor, no medical support. You had women who had such severe, one woman had such a severe UTI from like kind of prison conditions that she like turned blue in the face and passed out and almost died. And all of this, Josh, as some of the most protected political prisoners in Israel.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
There are young, healthy men
That's
who are going into prison, young, healthy Palestinian men who are going into prison in Israel at 19 years old and dying at 20.
Yeah.
And Israel just says they're dead. No explanation. This is happening all the time. There are 16-year-olds who are, you know, going to prison and coming out at 20. One of the reasons, you know, I think it's both important to tell a story and not to overstate the gravity of our experience is that, as you said before, Josh, if this happens to international humanitarian workers,
right,
we can only imagine what's happening on the other side of the cell block, so to speak, in the case of Ketziot, you know, to the Palestinians who are imprisoned there. But, you know, wondering whether I should say this on camera. Fuck it.
You can, I always encourage guests, tell your story, say everything you want. If you decide later or to protect someone, you need to redact it. You text me. I see the edit all the timelines.
No,
nothing goes out without me hitting the button to publish it. So,
when I was 8 years old, Josh, I was diagnosed with something called oppositional defiant disorder.
You,
which means that I really don't like bullies, and I really don't like authoritarians, and I really was reluctant to let the State of Israel determine my ability to engage with, work with, collaborate with the Palestinian Liberation Movement. So about 3 weeks after our detention, together with a group of about 25 international delegates, members of parliament, writers, artists, intellectuals, I kind of sneaked back over the border and into the occupied territories. And two things affected me so much about this sort of illicit visit. illicit by their terms, right? I just want to be clear. I was never charged with a crime ever.
Right.
I never saw a judge or jury. I was held extrajudicially and against my will and abducted at sea by the Israeli authority. So I've, you know, they have no legal cause not to let me go to the occupied territories of Palestine. But two things affected me a lot. One was the warmth of the welcome, the gratitude of people in Palestine for the flotilla, for people acting courageously and confrontationally against the state of Israel. And the other was listening to students who were telling me stories about just because they study law, or just because they study human rights, or just because they study journalism, when they're in their second year of university or their third about to graduate, they'll just get picked up by Israeli authorities and thrown into a prison for young people. And they'll be held there not for 6 days, in my case, not for 6 months, but for 12, for 18 months. And so I think it's important to tell the story of the ways in which we were abused and tortured and systematically denied our fundamental rights as prisoners of war and members of the Global Summit Flotilla. I think it's important to tell a story of our abandonment by the United States government to explode the myth that, you know, in a zero dark 30 extraction mechanism, the U.S. State Department's always going to find you and save you. And I think it's important to tell that story. I think it's even more important to remind ourselves that the experience that we had in such a pyrotechnic fashion, so visible to the global community, is one that Palestinians are having in such an invisible, quotidian fashion. And that has been, you know, I think very humbling, and I think also a helpful correction to a lot of the like support that the flotilla received. It's just like one of the biggest risks that we run as allies of the Palestinian Liberation Movement is making our solidarity episodic and having actions that are really powerful, but that fade in their aftermath. And one of the challenges that we have now is how can we sustain this movement? You know, the end of our detention coincided with this so-called ceasefire agreement and Trump's glorious trip to Sharm el-Sheikh to sign some deal for peace in the Middle East. I think that for many people, that concluded a chapter of kind of solidarity with the Palestinian movement. And it just concluded nothing about the condition of colonization, the condition of dispossession, the condition of genocide in the occupied territories, both in Gaza and the West Bank. And I think that's the reason why the flotilla keeps sailing. It's the reason why we're preparing for our next mission in March, April of 26, when the sailing season starts again. It's why we want to make it bigger and better and badder. More boats, more people from more countries, from more walks of life, from more trade unions and social movements and political parties. More representative, more powerful, more visible. But it's why I think in the interim, it's really critical to be having these kinds of conversations because nothing has changed. The annexation continues apace. The occupation is becoming ever more violent. The ethnic cleansing of camps like, you know, in Jenin and Nablus continue. And I think that there is a special obligation for us here in the United States to not just continue making noise about it, but continuing to, you know, mobilize and pressure our political representatives on these questions. I can tell you that as a U.S. American, I felt humiliated by the behavior of our political class with respect to our flotilla. And when I say that, I don't just mean the Trumpists who wished we were dead and would have kept us in that prison were it not for Trump wanting a Nobel Peace Prize and this whole thing to be over. I don't just mean the bureaucrats in the State Department who told us, we're not your babysitters, we can't help you, there's nothing we can do, despite us being the largest economic sponsor of Israel's war machine and our own incarceration as a result of it. When I say that I felt humiliated, I'm speaking about Democrats who failed to take advantage of the simplest, easiest opportunity to criticize the state of Israel and to stand up for the most basic rights of their citizens and constituents. I'm very sympathetic, much more than I should be or want to be, to how difficult it is sometimes to criticize Israel in this country, especially on the Hill. But in this flotilla process, we put a ball on a tee and we put a bat in the hands of our representatives. We basically said, we're prepared to endure some degree of suffering at the hands of Israeli forces for you to be able to make the case as colorfully as possible that this ally of ours is not actually an ally, that even when it comes to U.S. citizens, they're going to apply such force, repressive force, so negligent with respect to our rights and freedoms, that you can go out and make that case easily. And when I came out of prison, I saw they had done nothing. You know, really, the so-called, you know, the Zionist questioning class of pundits and policymakers that we have in this country had just let that opportunity pass. Madrid, streets were full, people were making noise, new policies around sanctions and settlements were advancing in the legislature. In Rome, streets were full. They were revising their own relationship to Israel. Same in London, same in Paris, in large parts of Europe, as well as in large parts of the global South. But in this country, we never fail to miss the opportunity to change and restructure our relationship to the state of Israel. And that, I think, is where I feel the most sense of depression about this country and this democracy, its capacity to represent the aims, ambition, and humanity of its people, and the most sense of motivation as well. Because in that gap between what we know people think and feel in this country on Palestine or on any other major humanitarian crisis to which we are the primary contributor, we know what people think. We know that people see these images and we know they're moved by them. And yet here is where our political class is behaving. We were on the boats. I couldn't get a single call, a single tweet. I couldn't get anything squeezed out of the people who are elected to represent myself. But even leaving aside my own case, the many veterans of conscience who had put their own lives on the line in places like Afghanistan and Iraq in service of this nation, who themselves were completely ignored, completely overlooked, and if not outright, like mistreated and abused by our government. And I think those are some of the lessons that we have to take from the experience of the flotilla here. I think the next one, Josh, is going to be much bigger. There'll be much more participation, even more attention. But the question is not, can we get from the demand side people to care and participate? It's also whether we can force a confrontation with our own domestic political class to give a shit. And that is a really open question.